I know. I love to have my headphones on.
There you go. They're right there.
Oh, cool.
Smooth series of notes makes up Ray Lynch's Hypnotic Clouds Below Your Knees, and it signals, as always, that it is 8 p.m. on Wednesday and time for So What's Your Story? We are the only program originating in Houston, Texas, devoted entirely to storytelling, right here on listener-sponsored KPFT 90.1 FM. Along with our team, co-host Mary Edgerton, Warren Holloman, Hank Rubicek, engineer Nicole Rocherlin, production intern Tatiana Gago, and last but never least, Floyd the Wonder Dog, we share the power of story by placing the spotlight on tellers who take us on magical and timeless and generally captivating journeys we can never predict, but we get to experience these journeys through the life it experiences and through the eyes of the storyteller. I'm Greg Audell, co-host of this amazing little program, and I am privileged to be your guide through some of the moving stories told tonight by some outstanding tellers. Tonight, our storytellers will share stories reflecting on life's difficult moments and the ones that are influenced by the children they love. Native Houstonian Connie B. believes that everything happens for a reason. And her first book, When Screaming Isn't Enough, not only makes that point, but has proven a personal victory. Her journey began in broadcasting, first as a radio announcer and news reporter, and then behind the camera in New Orleans. Connie's on-air television opportunity came at Cox Cable Television Station, and from there, she worked in the news departments at both ABC and NBC-affiliated broadcast networks. She was driven by her love of the industry and knew that radio and television is where she belonged. Then, as happens in life, two blessings came into her life, each bundled in pink, with the sweetest hearts known to the human spirit, she tells us. This took Connie in a new direction, one with purpose and the desire to be a great mom. Connie B., welcome to So What's Your Story?
Oh, Greg, thank you so much for having me.
Well, you've been in the storytelling and communication-based industries your entire adult life, I believe.
Yes.
What is it about telling stories about people that captivates you the most?
It's always so good to get people to talk about themselves or personal experience. And when you're trying to tell a story, even script writers or producers or whatever, it seems like the stories that are personal resonate more than any type of story.
Well, some of that to me comes back to the fact something we always say on this show is everyone has a story.
That's true.
They may not realize they have a story, but tragically, most are never asked their story.
Yeah.
And the listeners of this program know when I was a very young child, I had a strange hobby of meeting celebrities and interviewing them. And a wonderful journalist I know, the late Lucy Germany, she told me one day, she said, you know, all these movie stars that you interview, they're really interesting. Yeah. But if you ask the mailman the right questions, you're going to realize he's just as interesting.
Exactly.
And that has sort of been one of my guiding posts since I've become a storyteller, is everyone does have a story.
It's true. It's true, and it's amazing. I run into a lot of people once I tell them, hey, look, I'm not just a radio person, you know, radio and television. I'm also an author, you know, and it's like, wow, I have a book I've been writing on for the past 20 years. I'm like, so,
I understand
come on.
That. Well, or I think in my case, you know, the book's been being written every day of my life,
mm-hmm.
you know, and it changes a little bit every day of my life.
Yes.
You know,
yes.
And sometimes I just have to get the story done.
And I think that's the main thing that I have really tried to help someone. You know, I've tried to help that person that says, okay, I have a book that I'm trying to finish. And they say, well, could you help me? I say, you know what? Yes, I can. Because it took me 10 years to write my story. 10 years. But because of that, I'm able to actually help other people who have a story.
You and I may have to talk after this.
Okay.
What do you find most challenging in crafting a good story?
You know, a lot of times when you're thinking about writing a book, because even after I've written this one, I have another one in me somewhere.
I've never met an author, with the possible exception of To Kill a Mockingbird, you know, where an author only had one book in him.
Yeah, and that might be true. And I tell people, if you can get that one out, it's such a great accomplishment. But I think that it's putting the things in the sequence of events, because people normally try to jump from one part of the subject and of the story, and then all of a sudden they're at the end. But what about the meat of it? What about everything that led up to that particular event that you're trying to tell in the story? Detail oriented.
Please, my friends, listen to Connie B, because again, as listeners to this program know, what we often say is a good story has a beginning, it has a middle, and it has an end. And if it doesn't have those three components, it's not a story.
You got to take your time. You just got to take your time. And when I actually was able to tell my story to some of the professionals, and I was anguishing over, oh my God, you know, what is this? And he said, forget about it. Stop it. Don't worry about syntax. Don't worry about word structure. Just get it out.
Right.
Just tell
the
story.
Right.
Yeah.
Well, on that note, your first story reminds us of the unpredictability, the unfairness, the fragility of life. Will you tell us your first story?
When I started this story, Greg, it was not meant to be a story. I'm going through real life here. And as a single parent, I have two beautiful daughters, one named Anjali, and the second one is Dorian. She's the baby girl. The baby girl is what the story is written about. It's written about her. And as I'm going through just life and raising them, doing what I need to do, I have worked so many jobs. I have sometimes I felt like I was just bent over coming home. And it was a situation that if I did not write this book, I don't think God was going to let me sleep. One day, as I'm coming home from work, and my oldest daughter then was at University of Houston, and youngest daughter was in middle school. And, you know, we're going about our day. But all of a sudden, when I'm walking into the house, my oldest daughter is like, Mom, come in the kitchen and see what Dorian is doing. And, you know, I'm tired, you know, I've just worked a full day. And I'm like, Dorian, what are you doing? She said, Mom, look at her. You know, I told her, wash the dishes. And I'm looking at her and I see drool coming from her mouth, uncontrollable. And I'm like, Anjali is like washing dishes and, you know, doing normal stuff. And I'm like, Dorian, what are you doing? She looks up at me, you know, with this blank stare. And she raises her hand up to her mouth like, oh, what's this? You know, and just wipes it away from her mouth. And I'm like, stop that, girl. I'm thinking she's just being teenage, you know, and being trifling. That was the first inclination of something was wrong. As time progressed, my daughter lost control of verbiage and actions. I'm lying in bed and I'm tired. Normally I would let them get in bed with me. She comes down and she gets into the bed with me. And I'm like, Dorian, go upstairs. Mom's tired, you know. And she didn't move. And I said, Dorian, get up. I'm tired. Go upstairs. And she turned to me and she says, I'm not getting out of this bed. If anyone knows me, I am not the one. Okay, you will respect me. And she says, no, I'm not getting out of this bed. So I'm like, oh, yes, you are. By this time, Anjali had come down the stairs. And she says, Mom, Dorian just used all kind of language against me upstairs. And I don't know what's going on. And I'm like, what? I'm like, Dorian, all of a sudden, I literally had to physically try and move her from my bed. Next thing I know, we all are tussling in the bed. And I'm trying to get her out. And I'm like, see, I'm yelling at Anjali because I'm saying, you see, you're always trying to take her whippings, you know, when I'm trying to discipline her, you know, and now you see how she's defying me, and I'm literally, what? Literally, she's fighting back. And then Anjali looks at me and she says, Mom, something's wrong. I say, you better believe it is something wrong. She says, no, Mom, something is really wrong. And so I backed off, and so did she. And all of a sudden, I'm looking down at the bed, and Dorian is like this, and I wish the listeners could see me. But Dorian is straight as a board, hands straight in front, stiff as a board, laid out in my bed, not moving, not speaking, but looking straight up to the ceiling. And I'm like, oh, my God. I didn't know what to do. And I said, oh, my God, what is what? She said, Mom, something's happening. I call my brother, who works with mentally challenged children, and I told her to get on the phone, and because she had called me names. And I said, I put the phone to her. I said, tell your uncle what you just called me. And she did, and they're expletives. And I said, I don't know what to do. He said, get her dressed, and I'm going to call MHRH. Okay? And I'm going to take my glasses off in this because it really it takes me there. Because then all of a sudden, I tell her, I said, Dory, go upstairs and get dressed. We're going to go. She jumps up out of the bed. She gets this close to my face. She says, I'm not going anywhere. Now, as a mom and as a stern mom, normally I would react, but I was calm. And I said, it's okay, Dory. Just go upstairs, put on your clothes, and we're going to go to the hospital. She turns her head a little bit. And she says, okay. Eerily, and walks upstairs. She comes back down with, you know, some shorts on and you know, just a T-shirt. And I said, Dory, you know, get your jacket and everything and go upstairs and do that, you know. And she says, no. No, I'm not going anywhere. And I said, please, would you? She immediately calms down again and says, okay. See, the name of the book is called When Screaming Isn't Enough. Mm. I had almost lost it. But something inside of me, something that was from my upbringing, something gnawing at me saying, be calm. Be very calm. When Dorian came downstairs, she came straight to the front door. She sat down and got on her knees. I thought my child had lost her mind. As we were getting in the car, and I'm going and trying to tell you the sequence of events, because like when I say we're writing, when I wrote the book, I had to remember all of this, as painful as it was. Because as I'm going toward, she got in the car with me and everything, and literally on the passenger side, her legs are straight, so are her arms. She is straight out, just like this. I am in shock. Anjali is in her car. She's following me. We're on our way to MHRH. I said, I better call ahead to my primary physician. I called her and Dr. Paula Schlesinger. What a doctor. But at this point in time, she had an on-call doctor. She was out of town. And then another doctor answered the phone. And I said, my name is Connie, and I'm on my way to MHRH, and I really need you to be there. She said, well, I'm the on-call doctor. You're taking Dorian where? She says, listen to me. She says, please, don't take her there. I said, but they're waiting on me. She says, no, please, don't take her there. Bring her to Texas Children's, and if at all possible, she says, take her there for me. If you would, let us evaluate her first, then let us admit her. But bring her to us first. Please, I beg you, if you take her there, then we won't have control. Please. And I'm thinking, okay. And I'm turning, and I'm taking her to Texas Children's. But it was that phone call that saved her life.
Wow.
Saved her life.
Wow. And whatever that little voice that was inside of you.
It was God. It was nothing but God.
Wow.
Come on. Oh, Greg.
What a journey.
It takes my breath away.
I think you've taken all of our breaths away.
Yeah. To read this book, though, and I know we're moving right along.
Well, let's tell people, remember, the book is When Screaming Isn't Enough.
Yes.
And our guest and author and mother of the child in the story is Connie B. And it's a pleasure having you with us tonight. You know, your story is so powerful because I think we've all had times with kids when you just assume that something's going to be perfectly fine, mm-hmm. you know, or they're being difficult. And that horrifying moment when you realize, no, it's not a behavior issue.
Exactly.
It's a health crisis.
See, because many people, and this is what I encourage so many mothers and fathers, they think that the children are losing it, but they could just be sick.
Absolutely.
They could just be sick. So that's why I tell them, please, be easy. Go very slow and make sure you take all the steps to have your child evaluated before you make drastic moves.
Wow.
Yes, indeed.
All right. So I think because of where we are in the story, we're gonna have Connie B. continue with the continuation of this story.
If you don't mind, Greg, I'd like to give you a little read, if you don't mind.
Oh, I would love to hear you read a little bit.
Okay.
Absolutely.
So, are you ready?
I am so ready.
It's kind of a roller coaster. It's going to take you there. Get the napkins, everybody.
I've been sitting on the edge of my seat since you've been talking, so I'm absolutely ready.
Okay, here we go. This is from When Screaming Isn't Enough. She looked so thin and frail. When they saw how she couldn't answer any of their questions, they told me to send her to her room and let her rest. Maybe she'd feel better in the morning after things calmed down. They hugged and kissed her and let her know that they weren't going to accept this kind of behavior and that they'd talk to her tomorrow. Dory went upstairs, and my brothers hugged her and hugged me and let me know that everything would be all right. They said if I needed anything that night, I should call them. I'm setting this up where I called my brothers to come over and help me try to make some sense of what was going on with my youngest child. I was so mentally and physically exhausted, finally took a bath, laid down in bed, and by this time, Angie had come down. I wasn't in the mood to rehash what had happened. She saw that I was resting. She gave me a kiss and went upstairs. Now, I'm going to fast forward. She looked at me, leaned her head slightly to the left, and gently said, okay. She went back upstairs. I told her to put on long pants and come downstairs. She sat at the door, and next thing I know, she was having her arms and her head around her knees, and she was waiting. As Dory and I got in the car, she was sitting in the passenger seat with her arms all stretched out. I was watching this happen, but still could not believe it. I told Anjali to follow me, please, in the car because I was afraid. I didn't know what was happening. When I called to speak to Dory's pediatrician, Dr. Schwartz, she said, Connie, I need for you to turn the car around. I need for you to please take her to Texas Children's. I had no clue what was going on, and I just needed some answers. I said, okay, I'll go. So I headed to Texas Children's, and as we were sitting in the emergency room for at least 2 hours, they had finished taking her blood and running tests. As Dory and I were waiting in one of the examination rooms, she just started to get impatient, walking back and forth, then faster and faster. Dory, I said, please sit down and be patient. I told her, I said, you know how always this takes a long time. She kept pacing. Then suddenly she came up close to my face and screamed, go now, Art, now, go. I can't explain the sinking, gut-wrenching feeling that I had hearing this from my child. As calmly as I could, I replied, no, Dory, please sit down. We'll be leaving in a little while. We're at Texas Children's now. She was pacing even faster and faster, and then came so close to my face I could feel her breath again, and she yelled the same thing, go now, Art, go now. Fairly tall, very professional-looking physician came through the door with two interns. She says, he said, okay, Miss Williams. But before he could finish his sentence, Dory ran to where he stood, got uncomfortably close to him, and yelled at the top of her voice, go now, Art, go now. Just making absolutely no sense. The doctor's demeanor changed immediately, and he said very directly, you're not going anywhere until we finished. Dory screamed, go now. In the same breath, she hauled off and punched the doctor in the face as hard as she could, then ran out the door. Everything happened so quickly, I jumped to my feet and screamed, Dory, no! Then I ran into the hall that led to the waiting room, which was adjacent to the lobby at Texas Children's, that led to the street. The doctor ran after her. As soon as she passed the nurse's station and they all saw the commotion, they hit an alarm and shouted, code red, code red. Dory was hurdling the chairs that had been aligned in the waiting room. She was an athlete, track team, hurdler at school. Security guards, police officers seemed to be coming from everywhere. And as Dory sprinted to the last door, the one that led to the street, one of the police officers literally, if you know anything about football, clotheslined her. He stuck his arm out and it went right under her neck. And as his arm went under her neck and yanked her back, you think that would have slowed her down. Well, it didn't. It seemed as if she had the strength of a man. She was successfully landing punches on the police officers. Her legs were strong and wiry. She was completely out of control. One of the officers, she hit so hard that he fell to the floor. She was hitting them with all of her might. I said, Dory, please, baby, please stop. As I fell to my knees, if she got through that last door, they would not have been able to catch her. The doors were, and the doctors were shouting, grab her legs, grab her legs. One doctor slid under her while she was kicking and jerking. He grabbed her by the head and neck while a couple of the police officers grabbed her arms and body. I could hardly explain the sight that I saw. Dory was screaming, no, no, go. Her whole body was jerking as she tried to break free of their grip. A couple of the nurses grabbed me. Miss Williams, one of them said, please, Miss Williams, don't faint. We need for you to confirm. We need for you to confirm. She shook me because I was crying hysterically as I watched what was happening with my baby. Confirm, they shouted. Confirm, Miss Williams, we need your permission. Everything was happening so fast. The doctors, the police, and then Dory was like, no, mommy, mommy, no. But they grabbed her. They threw my baby on the gurney, secured her with these huge leather straps around her ankles, wrists, and neck. And then she looked at me with a strange, hateful expression and yelled, you did this, you. Her eyes seemed to roll back into her head as she again screamed, you did this. And then she said, no, mommy, no. For one of the nurses turned me around and repeated, Miss Williams, we need your permission. And I'm yelling, for what? She said, to save your child's life. She says, do you confirm? I said, yes, I confirm.
Wow.
And that was the beginning.
What a beginning. What was the time period between you having a normal day and where you just left us?
That's a very good question. I don't know.
It doesn't sound like it was much time.
No, it wasn't. It happened so fast. And please forgive me, because it takes me there.
I'm sure. Well, you've taken us there. And let me give you a minute to catch your breath.
Okay.
I'll tell you what, I've got a couple questions for you, but I think...
Yes, please. I'm good. All right. You know, it's just like, go there every time I tell
I mean, your
story
is such a powerful reminder that no matter how hard we try to protect these amazing little kids we love so, so much...
Yes.
...that there's so much that's completely out of our hands.
Yeah.
And also that life's most difficult decisions will often come at you when you are not expecting it, not prepared for it. What is the greatest lesson, or one of the greatest lessons, that you've learned from this experience?
you really have to believe and trust in God. I feel sorry for those of us who really don't know the power of faith.
Amen.
And the power of having godly people around you. Literally, Dorian went from being 14 to 2 years old in 1 week.
Wow.
14 to 2 years old in 1 week. What I learned is that with the power of faith, you can do just about anything.
Well, I certainly believe that, and I know, you know, our listeners are of every faith and no faith,
right.
But I certainly could not have gotten through the challenging times in my life without a firm belief in and relationship with God, and that's how I've handled challenging things.
Yes.
For me, it's been a critical part of the answer. You know, your story makes me reflect on my amazing niece, Morgan. When she was about 2 years old, we took her to a family wedding, and along with my other niece, Hannah, who I think she was about four at the time.
Mm-hmm.
And they danced and danced and danced. And then for weeks after, whenever Morgan was at home, she was two and a half. She loved to dance. And she would turn on her radio and she would dance. And if you walked too close to her, she would say, "You're in my wedding."
Oh, my.
Yeah. And one day, Morgan got the flu. It was Valentine's weekend. And my sister took her to the doctor. And it was a substitute doctor. And we didn't have the fortunate experience that you did of having a gifted doctor instead. And basically, I think they wrote it off at the flu. And I think my sister went back again. And they just kept saying it was the flu. And I'd been out of town. And when I came back to my sister's place, my niece was in bed. Something was clearly wrong.
Right.
You know, we didn't know what it was. And by the next morning, we realized she was in a coma. And my sister raced her to the doctor. I'm cutting out some of the steps along the way, but they realized quickly that she had spinal meningitis.
My God.
And they raced her to the children's hospital where she was in ICU and she was unconscious for too many days. And, you know, the other thing that's hard that, you know, though your children were older, it's so hard when you are when you're so focused on this child that you may lose,
right.
But you still have this other child that you adore that you're trying to explain it to.
Exactly.
And that was one of the memories I get was just, you know, the love I had for both of these girls and trying to balance that at a very trying time. Day after day went by and she was in a coma.
Oh.
After, I think it was about 5 days, I was in her bed with her, in her hospital bed, and we had her favorite cartoon playing, Madeline. And my sister asked my oldest niece, she said, "Hannah, do you want an apple?" Out of nowhere, it was like every bad movie of the week you've ever seen.
Wow.
This little voice goes, "Mommy, I want apple." And we look, and it was Morgan. And she didn't know what was going on. We start hysterically crying. All of a sudden, doctors, nurses, everyone comes in. And all Morgan knows is she wants an apple.
That's amazing.
It is amazing.
That's amazing.
You know, when she got out of the hospital, she was unable to walk. But she got that back very quickly.
Mm-hmm.
And one day, a few days after she'd been out of the hospital, she got her little radio. She turned it on full blast. It was so loud. And she looked at it, and she said, "Broken." And we realized she was deaf and she'd lost her hearing.
Oh, my God.
And thank God, because of my sister's diligence and modern technology, my sister figured out this amazing device was available called a cochlear implant, which is kind of bionic hearing in short. So she got Morgan the cochlear implant, and Morgan learned to hear again, learn to talk again, which was very challenging, took years. Morgan is now a senior in college.
Yay!
Where I had to write this down. She is a biology major with an emphasis in neuroscience.
Yes.
And her passion at this age is still dancing.
Look,
she was recently president of her dance group in college. And she still has, you know, the best big sister in the world and best mother in the world that, you know.
It's amazing that you would say that about the sibling. I only have one other daughter and she is the oldest. And as you were having that it's like it went to a miracle status. When I think about my oldest daughter and how she was also in this equation, watching and taking care of. And I think she's just an incredible young lady, because the diagnosis of what Dorian went through, they called it mycoplasma encephalitis.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Mycoplasma encephalitis.
Can you explain that?
And so, yes. In layman's terms, it basically separates the brain from the stem. She lost all cognitive reasoning. She couldn't, almost same as you. She could not walk. She could not talk. She didn't know who I was. She had absolutely no facial expressions. She went from like 125, 127 pounds to 89 pounds.
Wow.
And if you see the cover here on the book, you'll see when I say when screaming isn't enough, that is because once they made the diagnosis, there's a lot, Greg, there's a lot leading up to that. And I wasn't happy with...
I think medical science is more a medical art.
Yes, and when they say practicing medicine, let's take that at face value.
That's right. That's right.
But it was an incredible journey for not only my daughter, the baby girl that went through the actual heinous type of illness, my oldest daughter, that was taking care of the home, because I never left the hospital. They were like,
well,
you need
exactly.
to get up and go take a shower. And I was like, no, but she needs me. There was one point in this whole story that I had to hit the bed. I had to hit the edge of the bed and say, breathe, Dory, breathe. So that's one of the things that I appreciate so much about family and how we rely on, let's say, the sense of family, and how no one's going anywhere. Everybody's in it to win it. And I would definitely like to say there is a happy ending, Greg, to this story.
That I am looking forward to hearing
yes.
about. I think you and I both fought similar battles and are both extremely thankful and appreciative that we came through with healthy,
yes.
resilient, and appreciative young women.
Yes, yes.
Well, my friends, we have more stories to come in the second half of the show, but you are listening to So What's Your Story on 90.1 KPFT Houston, 89.5 in Galveston, and 90.9 for our friends in Huntsville, who are always part of this program. And my guest storyteller is author Connie B. Now, tonight, we have the unflappable Tatiana Gago. She is running the board, so you can hear us clearly, crisply, and hopefully without any coughing coming out of our speakers. How's 2018 been treating you?
Oh, so far so good. I've started my sixth semester of college
last
week. So just going to see how well 2018
Now, it's not the sixth time you've taken the first semester.
No.
Okay.
I'm in my third year.
Wow. I forget how smart you are sometimes.
Oh, thank you.
How did you deal with in the frozen ice last week?
Well, let me just say that cabin fever is real.
I hope no one was harmed in your home.
No, but I almost slid in ice. I was being very curious, and I wanted to get out of the house.
Yeah, don't do that. That was exactly what they were saying, don't do. Well, you know, we've always known, but now the entire country is taking notice that Houston is one of the nation's great storytelling meccas. Will you tell folks about where they can hear some of the city's wonderful storytellers?
It will be my pleasure, Greg. So to start, everyone needs to follow us on Facebook and please share our page with your friends and click like on our page so everyone knows that you really like us.
Yeah, we don't mean to be needy, but we need you to like us.
We have program clips on YouTube and all our past So What's Your Story programs on the Houston Storytellers website at www.houstonstorytellers.org. Just go to the radio program link on their site and enjoy. The Guild is also our proud sponsor. Their swaps meet the fourth Tuesday of every month at Temple Emanuel on 1500 Sunset. Also, don't miss our friends at The Moth at Warehouse Live the second Tuesday of every month.
Well, thank you, Tatiana. And let me say, the reason why we mention these groups is if you want to improve your public speaking skills, if you want to hear some great stories, these are incredible resources, you know, that meet each and every month. And I urge you to check them out. You'll be so glad you did. And one thing that every great storyteller has in common, They each had a first time when they got in front of that audience to tell a story, you know, and there's nothing magic about it. You know, you just have to get yourself to do it. This is Greg Audell, and you are listening to So What's Your Story on KPFT 90.1 FM Houston with my in-studio guest, Connie B.
Yay.
You know, parents are obviously devastated when their children are seriously ill. But despite that devastation, a parent's love that ignites the strength and pure grit that most people can only envy. Anne Garcia, our guest on May 7th of 2015, makes the point with the story about her daughter and the heart advocacy program she started because of her fierce love of her daughter. Tatiana, let's listen to Anne Garcia.
When I was a little girl, I was fixated on pregnancy. I wasn't so much into playing doll and being a mother, but pregnancy was just really and just very interesting to me. And so when I was a little girl, I would tuck a pillow under my shirt and I'd walk around and pretend like I was pregnant, much to my mother's embarrassment and probably my neighbor's concern as well. What is a five-year-old girl doing pretending like she's knocked up? I don't know. But I was always wanting to be pregnant, and when the stars aligned and I found my husband, an incredible man, and everything was set, I was on the cusp of starting our own family. I was really excited and I was very happy about it. And we didn't have a hard time getting pregnant, and so we were off to the races shortly after we got married, and I enjoyed every moment of the experience and it culminating in my son's birth. And I'm not one of these women who can say that she just, you know, sneezed and a baby was born. It was hard work, but it was also this incredible experience where it was just beyond anything. It was one plus one, my husband and me made three all of a sudden. And it was just an incredible experience. And from there, we knew that we wanted to have more kids. And so we started trying soon after our son Hugo was born. And again, it didn't take much, two margaritas this time. And I was pregnant with Ari. And unlike with Hugo, because I was looking after, you know, a six-month-old baby, I couldn't really enjoy the pregnancy as much, but it was still a great experience. And Ari looked, everything looked perfect during our pregnancy. And when she was born, I think she probably set a record. I started having my first contraction at 4:23 in the morning, and by 5:12 she was born. In fact, she beat the midwife. So I was the first person to touch her, to feel my baby daughter in my hands. And it was profound. It was an incredible experience. And so we were now a perfect family of four. We had our son, and then we had our little girl, and everything was going perfectly. She looked great. There was one thing where she would, in the evening, have allergies. Both my husband and I have horrible allergies. And she seemed to also suffer from allergies, and so she would have a hard time breathing. And we would read up online, you know, usually at 2:00 in the morning, and everything said, you know, it's fine, don't worry about it, and try these different remedies. And we did, and usually it worked. But one evening, it didn't work. And in the morning, my husband said, you know, that at some point in the evening, she had gone limp in his arms, and this set off alarm bells for both of us. So I ended up taking her into the emergency room, and the doctors started questioning me immediately. Well, she must not be breastfeeding. No, she's breastfeeding. Well, you know, she's been vomiting all night, hasn't she? No, she hasn't vomited at all. And the entire time they're firing these questions at me, I'm getting more and more alarmed. And she's surrounded at one point by about 20 doctors and tiny little baby on this adult-sized gurney. And I called my husband, who had stayed at home with our son Hugo, and I said, you need to get here. They said it's bad. And I didn't know what that meant, and no one would tell me. And finally, I asked the nurse, I said, you know, what are we looking at? Is she going to die? And she just shrugged her shoulders and then walked away from me. We eventually figured out that there was something wrong with her heart. It was the first time that we had any indication of that, and they told us that they needed to move her to another hospital, which they did. They allowed me to kiss her and hug her, and I realized that at that point they didn't think she was going to make it. We went to another hospital. We waited for about 3 hours. Meanwhile, my son is just losing it. He's, you know, tired, hungry, you know, 10 months old. And finally, my husband went to the back and he brought out a doctor. And when the doctor saw us, she looked over at my son and she said to another doctor, "Well, at least they're still going to have one child." And I felt my heart drop and my blood just went cold, and I braced myself. When I was following her into the other room, I was prepared. I was prepared to hear what she was going to tell me, that Ari was dead. We got into the room, and there were more doctors there. And one sat down, he started drawing a heart for me, and he started telling us that she had something called transposition of the great arteries, and that it would require immediate intervention. And we asked, "Okay, well, when do we start?" He said, "Oh, no, they've already started." And later, I went back to him and I said, "Well, when we had that conversation, what were her odds?" And he initially wouldn't tell me, and finally he was like, "You know, we thought she was going to be died. She was going to be dead." It was a very scary 2 weeks, I would say. She was up and she was down. The peeps and the chirps of all the machines surrounding her would set me into a tailspin, and I couldn't make heads or tails of any of it. Eventually, we would find out that she had suffered some brain damage from the reduction in oxygen that was a result from the underlying heart defect. And going through this experience, I realized that we were really lucky, ironically, I guess. But we were lucky because we saw children in beds next to us die, and we heard stories of kids whose heart defects were so much more complicated than our Ari's. And it was in recognizing how lucky we were that we decided that we needed to do something, that we wanted to help other families. And we were going to take a portion of the overall cost that we would have incurred had we had to pay for the surgery as ourselves, and we're going to apply it to helping other kids. And that was really the impetus for OpHeart.
I love this story because it reminds us that we can often find a way to help others through our own painful experiences. And I think that's something, you know, Connie and I have both shared tonight. In fact, I found the best way to deal with a painful situation is to make the road a bit easier for the next person who finds themselves in a similar situation. You know, our collection of stories is not only astonishing, but serves us as a library of the human experience. And we love learning, turning to these stories to complement the ones so poignantly told by our in-studio guest. On March 25th, 2011, Larry Andrews wondered if anyone would care about his story about his autistic son, Joey. Well, not only did people care, but they helped him win a fight with the government leaders in getting funding for his boy's treatment. He told Hank that his story may not make much of an impression, but clearly Larry underestimated the power of his story. Let's give it a listen, Tatiana.
As I mentioned a while ago, the first place I went with my wife after we got the news was to my mother's house, and she's a woman of great loyalty, not only to the Houston Rockets and the Texas Aggies, you know, but to her faith and also to her grandson. She asked me early on, pals, she used to call me, "What can I do to help you?" And I said, "Well, Mother, just a relationship, you know, an autistic child requires constant attention. You know, it's a 24/7 type thing." I said, "Just a break." So every week she took him out and filled his life with lunches and going to the museums and so forth, and they had a wonderful time together. When Joey was 21, we found a place for him to live. All his brothers and sisters had gone off to college, so he went to what we call Ranch College. And he went up there to live with other citizens much like himself. And he and his grandmother wrote each other faithfully every week for those years that he was there. Well, a year and a half ago, my mother died. They lost that relationship in this life. The last thing she said to me was, take care of my precious Joey. And that's what I'm trying to do. So another expression of her love and her faith, she was a good Catholic. And at some point, when he was 25, she kind of had that sheepish look. I knew she wanted to ask me something. She says, can I baptize Joey in the Catholic Church? And I thought, well, why not? So, you know, normally when you join a faith, other than in birth or, say, young, when you're baptized as a baby, you get a chance to choose. There's a little theological examination. So I'm not a great theological person myself. I had left the Catholic Church. I remember my mother saying when I voted Republican, it was the only disappointment she ever had compared to me leaving the Catholic Church. But so that night, I'm talking with Joey, and I decide to prepare him for this tradition. I ask him, Joey, who is God? Don't know, he answers. Now, my Joey is a man of few words, but clear answers. I said, well, do you know where he lives? Joey looks at me. Don't know. Well, he never wastes his word. I couldn't help but repress a little smile. And, you know, Joey's words often amuse me. But after this humorous phase passed, it occurred to me that my very own answers to those questions are, I don't know, I'm not so sure. So we go to the church the next day, and we're up there, we're presenting him to the church, Joey's center of attention, and he loves that. And so I have a chance to say a few words to the community. I say, we're presenting Joey to you today without the baggage of deep intellectual reasoning about his faith, but that I think he can teach you something about service and friendship that are something that will pass any educated person's test of religious love and faith. You know, he loves the candles and the bells and giving the peace sign at the Mass because he goes with my mother. You know, Joey doesn't lie. He wouldn't hurt a fly. One time we were walking down a path, he saw an ant. He held up. I mean, his regard for life and so forth is deep and expressed. I call him the little Buddha because he's always in the present moment. So, and he's not discontent. He has a simple life and he likes to be of service. So he's happiest when he's helping. So, you know, his tastes are pretty simple. He likes pretty girls, macaroni and cheese, and he likes Cokes.
Sounds absolutely normal to me.
Yep, and he's trusting and transparent. But I think that he may comprehend things that you and I don't understand so clearly. You know, he's lived a life in a state of innocence, and perhaps in matters of faith and trust, it is he who can teach us rather than we can teach him.
Yeah.
Friends, I apologize. I neglected to tell you at the beginning of this program that you should have a handkerchief or paper towels ready if you're like those of us in the studio. So I would suggest, you know, if you haven't already, get yourself something to dab those tears if you have any. Guest Stephen Winkler had never told a story in public before. He felt a need to tell this one about his father on March 5th, 2015. Would you play Stephen's Loss of My Father?
So, as you know, my father played a huge role in my life. He's the smartest man I know, always ready with a joke. And anytime I needed his support, he was there to give it to me. And it's thanks to him that I am the man I am today. And I thank him so much for being a part of my life. But unfortunately, about a year ago, my brother called me, letting me know that he would no longer be with us. 3 days or 2 days earlier to that call, my father was placed in the ICU, where he was placed in there for a severe case of the flu and some chest pains. My brother and I went to go visit him immediately, and while he was sick, he seemed so full of life. He smiled at us and was happy to see us, and we greeted him as we entered in. And as we asked him how he was doing, he quickly changed the conversation to let us know what we should do in case anything were to happen to him. Things like what we should do with the house, how to take care of my mother, and how I'd continue my education, which was a very important thing in him. So while all this was hard to hear, I didn't believe any of it. I I have been through this before with him and other family members, and we've made full recoveries. So any advice he gave me, I took with a grain of salt. But one thing he said really stuck with me. He said, "I'm very proud of you, and I think you know that." Now, normally, anyone is striving to make the people that are their role models proud, and they live for that moment of acceptance, but something sour was about this. It didn't feel, you know, it was more dread than it was hope and happiness, and I just couldn't figure it out. And I didn't have much time to reflect on that as the doctor came to take him away for procedures. So we left for the day. The next day, though, I thought about what he said, and it felt like he was telling me that his job was complete in making the man I am today. But for me, it wasn't. I still had so much to learn from him, so much to do with him, and I relied on the future to give me those experiences. I still couldn't believe anything could happen to the Superman that was my dad. But after that phone call, I had no choice.
Yeah.
The hardest thing in life is seeing the most important person lie there still. It just kills you inside. And I just couldn't take it. But I asked the staff to give me some time and privacy with them, and they closed the curtains to do so. And as I held his still warm hand, I could only think of one thing to say. I'm not done making you proud. And I've said that every day since. I'm not done making you proud. Because he still makes me the man I am today. And for that, my job has only just begun.
Wow. And we are so glad he did. You know, and it's funny, without ever knowing Stephen or his father, I feel like I know a great deal about both of them and the kind of man that his father was. Connie, what's your impression of a young man telling a story like this?
You know that young boys and young men are always like, we know that they're trained to never cry and to be so strong and to not have empathy. But did you hear his voice?
Absolutely.
He was so hurt, so stricken, but yet he found the positive in that.
That's right.
Which made him drive for his life to continue to make his father proud.
And friends, you must, because giving up is not an option.
That's right.
That is not an option.
That's right.
Well, my friends, next week, Dr. Warren Holloman will be our host, and his guest will be Ted Swinley, founding artistic director of Stages Theater and creator of the hit musical Always Patsy Cline, which is an amazing show. Ted will tell tales from his new play, Tales My Grandmother Told Me. And this is going to be a great show. So don't miss it, my friends. Connie, how do you know when you have a story people need to hear?
Well, you can feel it inside of your heart and soul, especially when you know that it's something that you can say to help someone else. Because I know in raising children, inside of when screaming isn't enough, oh, they're going to find so many little tidbits of information, of patience, love, faith, strength, courage.
Well, you know, there's so much more about your story and about your book that I want to know, but we are almost out of time. Is there any possible way that people can find out more about your story?
Well, I'm glad you asked, Craig. You can find When Screaming Isn't Enough on Amazon.com. by Connie B. And that's C-O-N-N-I-E. Middle initial is B. And Greg, I say that because there is someone in this city with my same exact name. So it's
I discovered that when doing my research. And I was so confused because the person sounded almost crazy, because I was like, these are two completely different lives this person
yes.
is leading.
And I'm a girl.
Yeah. And then I realized, I was like, oh, okay, these are two different people.
Yes. So it's on Amazon.com, When Screaming Isn't Enough.
Well, Connie, I'm going to tell you, we are going to want to have you on again. And I know you have more stories to tell. I can't wait to read this book.
Yes.
I can't wait to see your next book. And are your daughters listening tonight?
One is living in Dubai. And
she can still listen.
Yes.
She can still listen at kpft.org or listen to our archive at houstonstorytellers.org.
Okay. And the baby girl is listening right now.
All right. Well, I hope she feels that, you know, a lot of people she's never met are sending her love tonight.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and, when they read the story, they'll see that it has a happy ending.
Oh, we like happy endings. We are big fans of happy endings. So what's your story? And, you know, I feel blessed that, you know, my family had a happy ending with Morgan.
Praise God.
Praise
God. That's
all
I can say.
Thank you, Connie B., for sharing your stories and for the insights that both encourage and inspire us. I am proud to have you as my guest, and I look forward to many, many, many wonderful stories from you.
It was my pleasure.
Well, Wild Bill and the Vinyl Avenger are up next. Make radio a part of every day while you're driving home, if you need a break from the day, if you're turning in for the night, or if you're just chilling out. Join us every single Wednesday at 8 p.m. for So What's Your Story? And treasure what you hear. You keep loving a great story, and I promise we will keep bringing them to you. Above all, be good to each other. Tip well, even when you don't have to. Help when you can. The entire So What's Your Story team and I will always be searching for the next great story. And we will be forever reminding you that it is never too late to live happily ever after. Peace, my friends. Till next week. Thank you.
Thousands of you have heeded the call, but there's always room for more. You can find KPFT on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. From our latest updates to funny videos, contests, news, and more, you can find us anytime, day or night. We're at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. We'd love to give you the latest. Plus, you're already on Facebook. Why not get behind the scenes of Houston's leader for independent music, arts, ideas, and culture right now? Again, find us at KPFT Houston on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube. See you there.
By joining KPFT's Sustainer program this hour, you can support your local non-commercial station and help KPFT reduce its pledge drives. Rather than giving a yearly gift, Sustainers give a monthly donation that continues as long as you want. Giving 5, 20, 100, or more monthly helps change the way KPFT works. Sustainers help us meet our operating expenses without days and days of on-air fundraising. That means less pledge drive, more efficiency, and greater stability for KPFT, regardless of the time of year. Again, visit KPFT.org to make a difference today. This is 90.1 KPFT Houston, KPFT.org.